Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? Actually, if you don't need to answer that, I just hope something good has happened today, because right now something good is going to happen, because the Two Shot Podcast is back. I know. I've just checked and I thought, God, it seems like a long time since we had that episode with Jack Loudon. And I looked at the dates and it is, it's like 5 weeks ago. But life and homeschooling has just got in the way. But the good news is, yes, today we are back, and we will be back at the usual time and date next week, next Thursday. The next month we've got in the bank, and just you wait, some really interesting, fascinating, funny conversations coming your way over the next 4 weeks with some brilliant people. I just said with some brilliant people. Yes, it's late, I'm tired. I'm recording this at 5 to 9 on Thursday night. But for you, happy Friday, end of another week. What else has been going on? Yeah, lots of recordings. It was lovely. I saw producer Griff in the flesh for the first time a few weeks ago in a year, which was surreal and brilliant at the same time. I can't tell you, we're not allowed to tell you, of this new little project we're working on, but it's great to be back in the room with him, and he's on fine form. And a few of you got in touch and said how much you really liked the Q&A episode that myself and Griff did a while back. I can't remember when that was. Oh, everything blurred now. The days and weeks are blurred, aren't they? Let's get some clarity back. So maybe we'll do one of those in the future. That sound good? Maybe we'll do that, shall we? Yeah, maybe we will. But this week, it's episode 141, and I had a sit down in my house, and Catherine Rose Morley had a sit down in her house, and we connected over the internet, as is the way. But she's great. Look, you're going to know Catherine. She's an incredible actress. She's from Liverpool. If you're a big fan of Last Tango in Halifax, you'll know her from that. You'll know her from Channel 4's The Mill. And she's going to be starring in the new drama, The Syndicate, which is going to be on BBC One. Also starring past TSP fave guest and all-round superhuman. He's not a superhuman. Mr. Neil Morrissey. So, yeah, obviously we're all going to be tuning in for that. Should we get down to it? Let's do it. This is episode 141 of the Two Shot Podcast with the brilliant Catherine Rose Morley. Enjoy, and I shall see you at the end. That's a bit croaky there, sorry. Get to the episode.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Finally, I'm not going to bore the listeners, but we had technical issues last week when we wanted to do this, Kath, didn't we? But we are sorted now. I'm not going to ask you how you are, and that's not because I'm an incredibly cruel human being. It's like every time people ask now, it's like, oh, well, what do you think? It's just grim. So, and I don't want to touch too much on what's going on in the world, because what's left to be said?
Yeah, same old. It's every conversation is the same, isn't it?
Yeah,
every conversation.
Frankly, it's just slightly dull, and people tune into this to get away from that. But I do want to touch on what's going on with regards to work, even though we're not going to talk too much about work, but this is more about... I've had a few people say to me that they, even though they're not starting back yet, they're feeling quite cautious about it.
Yeah.
And it increases their anxiety. And I've tried to reassure them. I've said, well, certainly the sets that I've been on late last year were incredibly safe, you know, in some respects.
Safer.
You know, the safest place to be.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about you, and you were one of the first people I know that was going back.
Yeah, we did. It was about 5 months after our initial start date. Mm. So it was, you know, it felt like a big chunk of time, but we were one of the first. And I think I was slightly nervous and think, oh, what's this new world going to be like? But Kay and everyone at Rolland were so brilliant about it, and the BBC, and we actually did, we all got tested beforehand, but we did a very initial, which I've never done before, I don't know if you have, like a pre-shoot day, just to kind of see how everything was going to work, and if we couldn't use any of it, it's fine. Mm. And it was like, it was so invaluable, because it was just this one day to kind of, everyone to figure out what's happening, what we can and can't do. And I think everyone just kind of like relaxed a little bit and thought, oh, okay, just breathe a little bit. And then we kind of, then from there you get into a rhythm of how it works. And like you said, it is one of the safest places, because everyone is so cautious because, you know, productions have carried on and then had to stand down because someone's, and it spread so quickly.
Which is happening more and more.
Yeah, you keep hearing it.
For a production started, you know, speaking to somebody a while ago, oh, we started filming for 2 days and then someone tested positive. Well, that's it.
That's it. Shut down.
Shut it all down.
We were really lucky that we didn't have to stand down. We did have a couple of cases, but we'd caught them before they'd come into contact with anyone, so before they'd come onto set. So we were so lucky in that respect. But I think anyone who is feeling slightly anxious about it, I think it's been happening now. So we started in August. There's, you know, COVID officers on set. You all have to, I don't know if you've done this as well, we have to take an online COVID course. So we're educated. And I feel like every measure has been put into place.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
on
it's so
many levels.
Just complete vigilance.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to sign the forms
every
day before you get into work, make sure you get scanned, tested twice a week, sometimes three times a week.
Temperature checks on a daily.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, though, the fear that I was going to test positive, though, every time that COVID test came round, I was like, oh, God, I hope it's not me. It's like taking it's like taking an exam at school when you think, oh, God, have I revised enough for this? It was a bit like that, and you go, oh, please don't let it be me. Please don't let it be me.
I don't want to be the one that shuts the whole production down.
I know. And the later it got on in our shoot, we actually ended up at the end of the shoot, we went to Monaco, which was incredible. But obviously the later it gets on, we have to get the work done. We can't afford to stand down at that point in the game. So that the last couple of weeks were a bit tense of going, everyone stay very, very safe. So we were in Monaco, but couldn't go anywhere. We just stayed in the hotel.
I mean, you were so incredibly lucky to actually even
go.
Be able to fly over there.
I know.
Because I know it wasn't originally Monaco, was it, that you were going to?
Yeah, it was originally Vegas.
It was Vegas,
it was,
wasn't it? Yeah.
It was Vegas. But I do have flashbacks from Vegas from a very drunken hen do, so maybe it's a good thing that I didn't go back.
Let's face it, probably Monaco was the safer option. Yeah. No, I remember a very excited Neil Morrissey telling me that he was going to Vegas.
I know, he'd have loved it. But I actually think it's funny how things work out. For the story, I think Monaco is actually a much better place to be.
Right.
I think the disparity between the rich and the poor is so much greater over there. Really is the wealthiest of people. Whereas in Vegas, you know, pretty much most people can go to Vegas if you save, you know, a little bit, or, you know, Whereas Monaco is, it's high end. It's where you go when you've got the millions. So.
And it's like what you were saying before, just with regards to work. You, after a while, for people that are nervous and feeling quite cautious, you do get into that rhythm.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's like just like now with day-to-day life. If you go into a supermarket, you're putting it on and you're coming out, you're immediately cleaning your hands.
Absolutely.
It's just second nature. You just do it. So you get into that rhythm.
It just becomes such a routine. And I think once you're there, it's like you said, you know, going to the supermarket, whatever. It just, this is our daily life now, and we adapt. And
did you feel a great sense of relief when you'd wrapped up the series?
100%. Yeah. 100%. It was just gearing up to kind of get it finished. We had to, you know, take our time and enjoy it as well. But there is a massive relief because, especially for me and the other guys in the syndicate, we were in pretty much every single day. So there is a real pressure on, you can't have that, you can't get it. Because if one of us get it, it really does, you know, they can't rearrange the schedule, they can't put other scenes in, we're in every scene, so it's the relief. I remember getting home and opening a bottle of champagne as soon as I got in. I was like, I'm done. We did it. It was great.
I mean, it is a tricky thing. I mean, you know that when the long-running soaps went back, they sort of adapted and just went, right, well, it's just two people in a scene and we can shoot this and we can carry on the storyline, we can adapt. But with an ambitious ensemble drama, what you've been doing, it's like, if anything goes wrong, it's a house of cards, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think there was a moment as well where, when we did the bit before we picked up, Kay thought, shall I change the script? I think she had a moment of, shall I bring COVID into it? And she thought, no. And I'm so glad she didn't, because, like, even, you know, we're talking about it, and I think people just, I'm definitely getting to the point where I'm like, even the word COVID is getting on my nerves. It's everyone's just so fed up with it that I think we are leaning more towards programmes or films or whatever that just have absolutely no bearing on the world that we're living in right now. I think we all need that bit of escapism. I know I definitely do. I know I definitely do.
God.
And I'm having to, like, I can't watch the news anymore.
I stopped doing that quite a while ago. There's certain times when I need to, maybe once a week, or I'll listen to some sort of headlines. And, you know, the Saturday and Sunday papers are all about the recipes. That's the escapism. Get into the kitchen.
Oh,
and get cooking.
Definitely.
Tell you what annoys me even more is when people say COVID. But that's a completely different podcast, and let's not go there. Let's talk about Liverpool.
Yeah, let's
have a great, great city. That was one of the last cities I went to before.
Was it?
Well, I was.
Were you working?
Yeah, I went to an exhibition at the Tate.
Oh, great.
And had some food when we were allowed.
Oh, where did you go?
And I went to a lovely restaurant on Bold Street called Mirai.
Oh, love, you know, Mirai. Love it.
What?
So good. So good.
Absolutely spectacular.
Yeah. It's gorgeous.
Big shout out to Mireille. Please come on. Welcome. You can sponsor the podcast when you like. But let's talk about growing up in Liverpool. Whereabouts were you when you were growing up?
So I grew up in a place called Walton Village, which is in South Liverpool.
Right.
And it was me, my mum, my dad, my two older brothers. And, yeah, I'm very lucky that I had such a brilliant childhood. I was a very close family, all of us, you know, we are really close. And now that we're all grown up, and even though I don't live here anymore, we're all so close. Both of my brothers now have children. I've got five nieces and nephews and one on the way. And it's, you know, it's a mad house when we're all together. But I love it. I absolutely love it. And I remember feeling like I was quite maybe naive, maybe quite innocent, of going, every family's like mine. You know, I was so naive to that until I moved to London and went to drama school. And I went,
I'm far from it.
And I went, and it was a real reality check. And I think I grew up quite a lot and realised, wow, I'm very, very lucky that I've had the parents that I've had and the life that they brought me up in. And, you know, even just, you know, we didn't have much. You know, my mum and dad are very, you know, working class. My mum and dad both left school at 14 to work. They never did any higher education, worked their entire lives. But the support that I have from them, and even now, even like at 31, and sometimes you think you get to 18 and you don't really need your parents anymore. I've needed my parents more in the last couple of years than I think I ever have done. And I think I feel, very lucky about that.
I think, you know, not to bring it back to, you know, current circumstances, but I think a lot of people have found, even if they haven't been with their immediate families, that in some respects it has brought them closer together. Obviously not physically, but I think it has done from, you know, just dropping a quick text or for having a little phone call.
Definitely. Well, funnily enough, I haven't lived at home for about 11 years. So I was meant to start the syndicate and I thought, I'll go and see my mum and dad for a week before filming starts, because you know what it's like, you get busy and you can't see them as much. Then it was lockdown, so I ended up staying with my mum and dad for I think it was about 14 weeks, and now I haven't lived at home for 11 years, and then it was just me, mum and my dad. It was hysterical. How one of us didn't commit a murder, I don't know, but like, it was a massive shift for us all, massive shift, because my dad is a workaholic and always has been. He gets up at 3 a.m, he's at work for 4, and he gets in at like 6. And that is his whole life and always has been.
So what does he do, your dad?
He's got a scaffolding company.
Right.
And that's all he's done his whole life. And then all of a sudden, nothing. Like, he works 6 days a week, and then it was like he was in the house and he was like living with a child. Because he just didn't know what to do with himself. But we found our rhythm, we found our routine. And retrospectively, I look back and I think, I will never, ever get that time with my mum and dad ever again. Do you know, I never, ever will. I'd never get just us for that amount. I've never been home, just the three of us, for that long, in years and years and years. And I feel so blessed that I can look back and be like, I spent that time with them. And like you say, we definitely had our moments.
Well, it's inevitable. How incredible that you were all, with time, able to adapt.
Yeah, and we did not necessarily very quickly, but we did. We did our walks. I did a lot of baking, which everyone was happy about. I said, if my dad was like roaming around, I'd go, Dad, I'm just going to make a Victoria sponge. And he'd be like, oh, yeah, go on, girl. Yeah, go on. And he's all right then for the rest of the day. I know how to get around him. Just bake a Vicky sponge.
God, yeah, he did. He reverted to the child.
Oh, my dad,
not you.
Yeah, 100%. And it's a shock. You know, my dad's, he's in his 60s and his whole life has been work. And I think it was a big shock. But in some ways I'm glad, because it slowed him down a little bit. He was forced to slow down.
Well, that is the thing with people who, whether they're workaholics or not, always need to be on the go. They need to be doing something. Yeah. And when it's an enforced lockdown, and you go, well, no, I'm taking this away from you. You can't do anything. You've got no choice but to adapt.
It was tough, and I think everyone had their own experiences of it, didn't they? But we managed to get through it relatively unscathed. And we're all still friends. just about.
And can we talk about school?
Yeah, let's talk about school.
How was school for you?
Do you know what? I loved it.
I knew you were going
to
say
that. But not academically. But I loved going to school to be with mates.
So more the social aspect.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I was kind of like in the middle. I wasn't the brightest. But I also did. I quite like schoolwork. Is that a really bad thing to say?
No.
But it's not really. It doesn't make me look very cool. But I did. I quite enjoyed it.
There's nothing wrong with not looking cool.
I'm not. Okay? The thing is, I'm not cool. I'm past the point of trying to pretend that I am. Definitely not. I'm definitely not. Even my 5-year-old nieces don't think I'm cool. Which I really
they definitely wouldn't.
But I really thought they would, Craig. I really thought I'd have me nieces on my side, but even they don't think I am.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wait till you start having children. Oh. If that's a path you go down, you know.
I know.
You'll never be cool. No. Don't worry.
But no, I did, and I've made some amazing friends, and I'm still friends now. There's a group of us. And it's the most invaluable group of girls that I have met. You know, we've been friends for over 20 years now. And that is the biggest thing I think I'll take away from school, is those, you just grow up with these, with this group of people, and you have this shared experience and history. And they're an amazing bunch of girls. They really are. I went to an all-girls Catholic school. It was very strict.
Right, okay.
Really strict.
Oh, was it very strict?
Oh, God, yeah. We had, you know, skirts down to our shins, and it was run by a sister. We all used to call her Sam, right. Sister Anne-Marie. Couldn't put a foot wrong. You know, it was really, you know, they were on it. But obviously, to, like I said, I wasn't particularly academic. And in my kind of teenage years, I realised that I've always danced. I danced since I was about, since I could walk, really.
Right.
And then I got to year seven, and I remember my dance drama teacher at the time being like, I think you should try some acting. I think you should go to a drama club outside of school. And I was like, really? She's like, yeah, I really think you should. So I did. So I went to the Everyman and Playhouse Youth Theatre and just thought, this is for me. I was like, I love it here. I just,
was that weekends? Or
no,
was
it, so it was after school. So I think it would be like a Tuesday evening, 6 till 9 it was, or something like that. And I did, and then I stayed with the Everyman for about 8 years before I moved. That was like my upbringing. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. That was like my childhood, is being there. And when I wasn't there, I wanted to be there.
So you had a great start of your education there, yeah, with regards to acting, but also the great balance of the social aspect, yeah, of wanting to be there.
I think that's one of the reasons I love this job, is the social aspect. I absolutely love meeting new people. I think that's always been in me, maybe, even since a kid, of just wanting to, I know, and to be around people who enjoy what I enjoy. Yeah. Do you know, when you meet someone who loves it as much as you, you're like, this is great. I want to be here. I want to be with these people.
Well, because you're all in the same, you're all in the same club.
Yeah.
It's like, you're all in the same gang.
Yeah. It's like having your own little gang.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, very lucky that I had that. And the Everyman's still going. It's an amazing place for young people, that the youth theatre. And I think without it, don't know what I'd be doing. God knows.
Well, going down a different path, surely, possibly.
Possibly. I mean, I remember getting to doing my A-levels and thinking, what am I going to do next? Because I never, ever, ever in a million years thought I'd do it as a job. Never.
Why is that?
I didn't think it was possible. I just thought it was a hobby. Like, my brothers played football and they loved that. I thought this was my hobby that I loved. I knew my brothers weren't going to be footballers. So I was like, even though they probably wish they were. I didn't ever in a million years. So I thought, well, maybe I should go to uni. So I thought, well, that's the only thing I really like. So I'll apply to uni. And I remember being on UCAS. I was looking at like different universities, and this place called Royal Welsh came up, and I was like, what's Royal Welsh? Is that a university? And I looked into it was a drama school. I actually didn't know what a drama school was. Didn't know that they existed.
Oh, you didn't even know they existed?
No, I don't know where I was sitting, but I didn't know that you could go to somewhere like that and do, you know, a vocational course. And I was like, I want to go there. So I auditioned. I think I got a recall but didn't get in, and I was devastated, absolutely devastated. So I decided to take a year out, and I worked in a couple of different schools teaching drama in that year. Yeah. And I thought, I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. Me and my mum got the train to Cardiff and made like a trip out of it, and I didn't know what I was doing there. Like, I just kind of went, turned up and did it, and then I realised, oh, actually, I need to think about this. I need to think about the monologues that I choose. And I tried to get a fat. Then I discovered all the drama schools and seriously kind of considered it in that year, and then went back. But even then, I never thought I'd do it as a career.
So even in that year off, when you were teaching in schools, you weren't thinking, oh, yeah, this is the job. This is what I'm going to be doing, or at least aspire to.
It's a really strange thing. I just didn't think that because it was a hobby that I loved, I didn't ever think I could make a career. I know this sounds maybe quite contradictory. I never thought I could make a career out of it because I never saw anyone around. I didn't know anybody in the industry to kind of go, oh, yeah, you could do it. I didn't know how you got into it. I didn't know what agents were. I was so kind of like, you know, naive to this whole industry. But I just knew I loved it. I loved going to theatre. I loved being in plays. And but there was a time that I remember in sixth form, I was meant to be going to like extra English revision classes. But I kept missing them because I was going to my drama, you know, classes. And my English teacher said something like, well, you know, you have to take this seriously. You know, what are you going to do after you finish? And I said, well, I think I might want to go to drama school. You know, kind of I'd said it out loud for the first time. I think I might want to go to drama school. And she went, well, you're living in cloud cuckoo land if you think that's going to happen. And part of me was like, I'm going to drama school.
Yeah. You've just, saying that, you've just.
I know, she
me
could
on.
Have even, she, if she hadn't have said it, I'd have gone, yes, miss, I will come to my English class. But I went, I'm going to drama school. And I do have that little bit in me of going, if someone says I can't do it, even if I don't want to do it, I'm going to do it. So I did it. And then the rest is history, really.
And you were saying earlier on when we started, what a loving and supportive family that you grew up in. Were your mum and dad supportive of this decision?
So supportive. They love it. They love it. That, you know, I think they're happy because I'm happy.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not brilliant all the time. I've had a tough couple of years of, you know, and I haven't, but you know what it's like being rejected and unemployment, and it's a hard profession. I think people see it as quite glamorous and...
Oh, far from it.
And, you know, when you're not working, well, you're not really doing much. You're just lazing around when you're not working. Actually, it takes so much spirit and resilience to carry on. And I think that is what being an actor is having that resilience and self-belief. Even when you doubt yourself, there is still something always inside that goes, I know I can do this. I just know I can. Otherwise, you would eventually pack it in and do something else.
Is that something that you've slowly learned along the way, or is it something that was instilled in you?
I've always been quite a strong person. I've always been quite independent, know my own mind. But I think but growing up, I was never tested of that resilience, really, until I graduated. And I had an amazing couple of years when I first graduated, an amazing few years, and then it just stopped. And I was like, oh, this is new. And it was tough. It was hard. And I did a job that was, you know, very well received. For the first time ever, it was probably the most I got paid. And I don't think I worked after that job for about over 2 years. Nothing. And I mean nothing. Not a single thing. And that was hard. That was tough.
Were there times over that period of the 2 years that you ever, did you ever consider just going, yeah, I'm
done.
Don't think I'm cut out for this.
Definitely. Absolutely.
How did you feel in those moments? Because it's quite, it's not the right word, but they are quite scary because you kind of walk in this emotional tightrope and you just can't cling on sometimes. And that's, it's a terrible feeling. It's almost like a nightmare.
It is. And do you know what else I felt is guilty? I felt really guilty in those moments because...
Why did you feel guilty? For what?
Because I felt guilty that I'd chosen to do something that was driven by my own kind of passions. And it wasn't quite where I was at and where I was, you know, my family had supported me and they know I'm doing it. And I'm talking, they did support me emotionally, but to begin with, it was very much financially as well. So I was thinking, am I letting them down? You know, what else could I have done with that? I remember after being almost 2 years thinking, what could I have done in these last 2 years? You know, if I'd chosen a different career, I might have done something different. But then I was on this like loop of But I have a good life. I have a roof over my head. I've got great friends. I've got great family. I've got a great boyfriend. But I feel like shit.
Yeah.
And I felt so guilty for feeling bad about those things.
And were you also feeling guilty because you were following a passion and things weren't working out, but also you were being, you know, emotionally and financially supported by your parents?
It was tough. It wasn't a joyful time because I did feel very dark about it. And then I thought, well, if I don't do this, what am I going to do?
Well, that's it.
And I thought and thought and thought about different alternatives. And I thought, there isn't a plan B. I've never had a plan B. Even though I never thought I'd make it as a career, as soon as I kept on going to that next step and then drama school and then getting a job, I was like, oh, this is what I'm doing. I'm not, you know, nothing's going to stop me now kind of thing. And then when it did, it's like, it's a bit of a reality check. And maybe, so, you know, looking back, you might think, well, I had it fairly easy. You know, I just went from school to the everyman and I did school plays and I it was quite a natural succession of things. Then suddenly, bam, it stops. And I think that's when the real work comes in.
Yeah.
I think that's when you have to dig deep and think, what am I going to do? You know, look yourself and then it also gets to a point where you go, right, come on now. I had to look after myself. I was living in London at the time and I was living with a friend from drama school and I said, I think I've got to go. I think being in London didn't help. I said, we had a couple more months on my contract that was here flat and I said, I think I've got to go. I think I'm going to go back to Liverpool. And I did. I went back to Liverpool for about 3 or 4 months and it was the best thing I ever did. Because London was like, it felt like it was closing in on me and it felt like everyone around me was doing something and was busy and I wasn't and I felt selfish and I felt guilty and I felt sad that I trained to do this thing but I wasn't being able to do it so I went home for a couple of months, got looked after.
is that what pulled you out of it, by going home, making that decision to get out of the city to go back to Liverpool?
Definitely. And then I went back. I went back a couple of months later. But I just needed a bit of time out.
Yeah.
And to go.
Yeah.
To reassess. I mean, you know, we spoke about it a lot. I think it was over a Christmas period. And I remember being at home and going, if this is what you want to do, keep going. And, you know, one of the best bits of advice my mum ever, I mean, she comes up with all kinds of nonsense, but the best thing she ever says is, what's meant for you won't pass you by. And it sounds so simple and so maybe a little bit silly, but I do believe it. What is meant for you won't pass you by. And I hold on to that. And then as soon as something good comes in, you do get a job, you're like, oh, great, I'm back.
It just changes
in an instant. And it feels so, all that panic and worry, you think. But I think the feeling of relief and excitement, it makes you realise you're in the right job. You're doing what you're meant to be doing.
And yeah, things fall into place in those moments. In the past few months, maybe things have been spinning out of control and you have zero control in those moments. It's funny, and I've said this before about feeling like that when you're in as big a city, as, you know, an unforgiving city that can be London. But I want to go back to when you did go to drama school and you were leaving Liverpool to go to London. How did that feel? I mean, I'm sure it's a mixture of, you know, nervousness and excitement wrapped into one, but it does kind of smack you over the head, London, when you first get there. I certainly found that.
It does, but I had this thing of, it sounds terrible, I remember my mum and dad bringing me down, helping me unpack, and then I was like, okay, bye, see ya. I was honestly so excited. I think my mum and dad were probably a bit upset that I wasn't upset, but I was like, bye, I'm here to kind of start my life. See ya, I'll be in touch. I thrived on it. I thrived being independent. And I think as well, because there's always, especially with two older brothers, I was always the baby of the family and the girl, and oh, I can't do that, Kath can't do that. Not in a bad way, but, you know, teasing kind of way.
Mm.
And similarly to my English teacher, I always remember I was on the stairs in our house and my eldest brother said to Mum, oh, Mum, give her 3 months and she'll be back. Because I think Mum was a bit worried about me, the baby moving to London.
Of course.
So another moment of going, I'm not coming back. I won't see you in 3 months. And I never came home, apart from intermittently. But I live down south, so maybe that was part of it, who knows. But it is a tough city. When things are great, it's a brilliant city. And when things are tough, it's hard. It can be brutal. Mm. It can be brutal. But I, again, was very lucky that I've gotten I made a really amazing few friendships at drama school. And I think that's imperative, to make your own little family down there. You know, if you do live away from home, is to find your little tribe.
Well, it's also that support as well that you need when things inevitably don't go to plan, because as anybody who ever speaks to me or writes an email through the podcast about, oh, I want to do this training, I'm thinking about this, I say, really do think about it and go easy, because, you know, the bad times outweigh the good.
Oh,
for sure.
I mean, we're unemployed more than we're employed. That's a fact. You know, there might be a very small handful that aren't, but the majority of us are unemployed. But it is that just keep going. Mm. If it's what you want to do.
Was it something, going back to the training at drama school, where was it? Guildhall?
Guildhall I went to, yeah.
Yeah. So during that time, you know, you've been thrown everything in the kitchen sink at you, and I always think it's very important you try and take what speaks to you and what's right for you.
100%.
But were you ever spoken about the reality, the darker times of when things possibly aren't going to go right?
Never.
I mean, it's key moments like that that I think should be spoken about.
It's really baffling, and I don't understand why there isn't more of an emphasis, even just a slight emphasis on it, you know, just even a little bit of warning, a little bit of what's to come. I think maybe they don't want to scare people off, I don't know. But I definitely feel like there should be, and I think maybe now there is, done more to kind
of... You would hope so.
To protect you. Because you're getting thrown in every which way direction. And a lot, some of it is invaluable. Some of it, like you say, you just have to take what sticks. There's some things that I'll never ever think of or do again. And there's some things that I do all the time that I learnt there.
But and also what's right for you
is not right.
Not be right for somebody else. You know, it's you're trying to tailor make this career and this profession that's right for you.
And I had an amazing time at Guildhall, but there is an element of kind of, like you said, it kind of treating everyone in a similar way. I remember, I think it was in singing, by the end of our second year, I remember our singing teacher saying to me, like making a thing of it, so, Catherine, you haven't cried yet. I was like, because I've got nothing to cry about. And I think that is where, you know, the realisation that I had a very supportive family. I went to London very grounded, very, had self-belief, and I didn't crumble. And I think they almost want, they you know, the whole thing of they break you down to build you back up. I didn't feel like I needed to break down, and it was such a big thing, and I was like, do you want me to cry? Is that like, does that mean I've made a breakthrough because I've cried? You've got to explain it to me better than just saying it.
You haven't cried yet, and this is kind of a rites of passage, and you need to,
basically. So, yeah, it isn't necessarily for every individual. And I also think drama school's not for every actor.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think it's necessarily the route to go down. It was definitely right for me. But I know actors, and Ollie, who you know, a boyfriend, he never went to drama school, and I think it's the best thing he ever did, not going to drama school.
But there's so many avenues of training and education now that is not the traditional route of, and not necessarily London, but, you know, going to do 3 years at drama school.
Yeah, yeah. I think it gives you an in some way, because obviously the agents come to your shows and that's how you kind of... But like you said, there's so many more avenues
more and more
now.
You know, you have to look at certainly something like the television workshop in Nottingham.
I mean, look how many people have come from there.
Exactly. More and more now, your certain casting directors have been going there to pluck people out.
Yeah.
Because they don't want someone who has gone through the drama school system.
Yeah, a lot don't.
Can I talk about your accent?
Yeah, sure.
And with regards to drama school. Because some training, you know, they do want to try and drum it out of you.
Yep.
And did that happen with you?
Slightly, yeah. I remember being taught, when, you know, we do accent lessons and then saying about speaking RP. And they wanted us to speak in RP solid. If you didn't have a natural RP accent, they wanted us to speak in RP all the time for about 3 months. And I was like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to ring home. I'm not going to speak to my friends. I was like, I would put in all the work, but I'm just not going to do that because...
Oh, so
outside I mean, 24-7. Yeah, 24-7.
Right, okay.
And I just, if you know, it's like any accent, I'll put the work in. But I'm not going to do it. And, you know, I saw actors over the years. It just got less and less and it got diluted and a little bit more. And I think that they believe that having an RP accent is... I see it as another string to me bow. Like, I'm grateful that I learned it. But I'm never going to change it completely.
No.
Because it's who I am. And I find it very sad when I see people now who I know had a very strong accent and now you wouldn't know where they were from. And I'm like, wow, how, because it's a choice.
Well, they've made a concerted effort to do that.
It's a definite choice because someone can advise you to do it. And, you know, I've definitely had things in the past with accent. I remember even related to our industry. I remember being on a train and I was going through I think I was going down for an audition or something. And a guy got chatting to me and blah, blah, blah. I think I was quite young and he said, oh, what role would you like to play? And I'm saying, I'd like to actually play Juliet. Romeo and Juliet. I mean, well, not with that accent, you won't. And I must have only been about 18 or something. And I was like, oh, I think that's probably the first time of feeling like, oh, this, you don't like my accent. Why not? It's just how I speak.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of brace yourself a little bit for those kind of things. But ultimately you just have to go, I don't really care.
And also stick to what you believe and what's
exactly,
true to you.
Exactly. And, you know, the older you get, it's a very difficult thing, especially in our job. You're constantly being kind of looked at and all those things, but judged at rejection. And I now try to not care about the opinions of people who I don't care about. Because why?
Oh, and it's the
hardest thing. It's nigh on impossible. But I'm trying so hard because why would I care what Joe Bloggs thinks?
Yeah.
I don't know him from Adam. You know, I'm talking about like people on Twitter or anything like that. Or even this guy on the train. Why do I care? Because I don't know who you are. You don't know me.
No.
But it's very, very difficult.
It's very difficult. And also, it's quite you would take that on as quite a personal attack.
Oh, it's so personal. What we do is we put ourselves out there as, you know, we're our own product.
Mm.
And I think when someone doesn't like it, that childish nature, and he goes, oh, why? You don't want to play with me? You don't want to be my friend? You know, and I don't think that goes away. I don't think it, but you just have to guess was like another thing. Just keep going, get through it.
That's why I can never watch anything that I do. It's like no,
nah, too much.
Do you are you able to watch things?
Not straight away. I can, as long as there's a bit of distance and a bit of. But also, when I'm at home, I don't have a choice because my mum's got everything recorded on Sky anyway. She still, no joke, she's still got the mill.
Has she?
Yeah, she's still got. She puts it on every now and again.
Available on 4OD now. Go and watch the mill. Very good drama. Do you ever feel, just sticking with the accent thing for a while? I was talking to a journalist a few weeks ago, and we were talking. It wasn't just about accents, although I did bring the subject round to that. But we were talking about class and being put into a certain box. Do you feel having a regional accent, you have been sometimes unjustly put into a certain box?
Do you know what? Thinking about it, I've never been asked that question. So I don't, to be honest, no, I don't feel like I've fully experienced that, because I've also had a lot of experience. I basically don't work it by accent. So maybe that has something to do with it, of going, well, if they wanted my accent, then maybe that job wouldn't be there anyway. I tend to not do my accent a lot. Honestly, maybe twice I've worked on my own. Maybe thinking out loud, maybe that does play a part. But I've also been lucky enough to maybe because I Guildhall did drum it into Overland and RP, I've done RP quite a lot, and on stage I've done it quite a lot. So I've been very lucky in how broad I've been able to play in terms of like class.
But are these your choices, or are these...
That's what I'm thinking. No, not very, very rarely.
Right.
It's always something that's specified.
In the text.
In the text or in the character breakdown.
Yeah.
But sometimes what annoys me is if they want a specific accent, but then they also say, but you can also do it in your native accent. So I'll go, oh, yeah, I'll do that. But they don't really want it. They're giving you the opportunity, the choice to do your own, but they don't want your own. They want what they've asked for. And it's such a conflict of going, well, do I do what I want to do? Or do I try and get a job? It's a really fine balance.
Just do it twice.
Or just do it twice.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose you can now with self-taste, but this is maybe like in the room auditions when you sometimes just get one shot and you're like,
in the room auditions.
What are they?
What are you talking about?
What's that?
That ain't going to be happening for a long time.
Do you know what?
I
missed so much just getting there 4 to 5 minutes too early and sitting at a prep and going over my lines. Oh, come back.
Those days will come back at some point.
Fingers crossed.
But you're in a good place.
Yes. I think it's been tough. It's not been the easiest journey. But we keep going. Life's not easy, is it? And everyone has their own stuff going on. No one has it easy. You just have to keep going. It sounds so simple, and sometimes that's impossible to do. But life goes on.
Sometimes people need to hear it.
Yeah, and, you know, my mum always says, Monday's going to come. So just crack on.
That seems like a lovely place to end with wise words from your mum.
From Joanie.
Catherine, it's been absolutely lovely talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming on. Can I just say how much I love your podcast, by the way? I absolutely love it and always have, and I'm very grateful and happy.
Oh, well, I don't take compliments, so we'll just wash
it.
We'll just say it very quickly,
and you didn't hear it.
Okay, well, I really, obviously, getting tongue-tied for the first time in my life. But yes, you know, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. And hopefully I'll see you in the flesh in the not-too-distant future.
Fingers crossed. Stay safe.
And take care.
Loads of love. Bye.
And another episode is done. Ah,
Feels good to say that again after such time away. How brilliant was Catherine? She's so lovely. She's such a breath of fresh air. And I really feel we need these conversations at the moment that are going to give us a little jolt and be a tonic for us. So I can't thank Catherine enough. She's always such a bundle of energy. And if you've been lucky enough to work with her or you know her, then you'll understand what I'm talking about. But hopefully if you don't, you'll get a taste. You'll have got a taste, rather, of who she is on this episode. And I can't thank her enough for coming on because we were supposed to... It's very dull, boring story. We were supposed to do it a couple of weeks before. We had some technical issues. We ironed it out. We got it sorted, and I'm so pleased we did. It's great that she kicked off our TSP drought of episodes. Now, do you want some homework? It's fun homework. Over the coming weeks, I've got two incredible actors, an incredible spoken word artist / storyteller coming on. But here, what about I give you some homework for next week? And look, I know you're watching telly, but what telly are you watching? What I want you to do is I'd love you to watch, if not all of it, then a few episodes of I Hate Susie, which is now available on Sky and Now TV. Look, that's legal. I'm sure you can find it illegally somewhere. I'm not saying you should, and I'm not saying I've done that. I'm saying I'm sure it's possible. But if not, then go down the Now TV Sky route, who are officially not sponsors of this podcast. Watch the Billy Piper drama I Hate Susie, because next week I have somebody who is closely connected to that, and she's quite brilliant. So, until next week, I've been Craig Parkinson, he's been producer Griff, and this has been the Two Shot Podcast, and it's really good to be back. Take care of yourself, stay safe, try and find some small little pleasures every day. Look after yourself. I'll see you next Thursday. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.